The honor to introduce Maria Pia Lara, professor in philosophy in Mexico City. Maria Pia, you're very welcome. Please, the stage is yours.
Thank you, Silvia. I would very much like to thank the Swedish committee organizers, most especially to Ulla Holm and to Mia Linusson, who have made this extraordinary conference possible, and of course, my invitation to be here and the honor to participate and to be able to share my ideas with you. I thought this is the last chapter of a book that I called Globalizing Justice, which I am waiting to have the reviews get back to me. So when I started doing the book after September 11, I thought of the idea of the need to think of the concept of moral authority. I think that it is important to consider the idea of moral authority because of what has been happening with leadership and political participation in the last few years. So in this lecture, I'm defending the idea that we need to fortify the concept of agonism along with the concept of moral authority in normative terms. And I'm going to do this first by revising and providing a connection with Arendt's theory of agonism and her conclusions on the idea of what could we call promises, which is the concept I develop as moral authority. So I'm going to begin. Action and speech become intertwined because both possess the revelatory character of self-disclosure. And when someone takes the risk of being self-disclosed in front of others, action needs, says Arendt, for its full appearance, the shining brightness we once called glory, and which is possible only in the public realm. That shining brightness was best described by Max Weber as charisma, a term he used from a religious lexicon to denote some kind of blessedness. Though Weber extracted the religious aura of the term and put it into the political arena, it seemed that it was one of the elements of action that he considered as irrational. Arendt's idea of agonism, on the other hand, makes it a very conscious choice of self-creation to become a public figure. The internal connection of her idea, which differs from Weber's concept of charisma, is that for Arendt, agonism is an intervention into the public sphere. It is seen as a process that needs to be established between a leader and its followers through carefully planned skills. A political leader can begin the process to become a hero. A hero, however, only becomes one once the true story emerges in the public sphere as a biography, a story of which he himself, says Arendt, is the hero. As we will see later, this connection is the explicit normative idea of understanding action and its relation to judgment. This is the reason why heroes need no heroic qualities. All they need is courage. Courage, for Arendt, is in fact already present in the willingness to act and speak at all. Thus, we can refer to our agonistic impulses as features we can acquire once we begin by disclosing and exposing ourselves. Arendt connects her concept of agonism with judgment through her idea of the theater as a political representation. The play is an imitation of acting, and only when the actors and speakers who reenact the story's plot can convey the full meaning, not so much of the story itself, but of the heroes who reveal themselves in it. It is in the theater that we set ourselves to enact a drama which is in the only place where we can find the true meaning of the agonistic actions of the heroes. Here, the idea of writing a story becomes a relevant part of a drama. Aristotle knew very well that the mimesis of an action is captured only when the written drama can be enacted. Thus, through the representation, we can judge an action and convey its full meaning. We bring the light to our heroes when we can begin to cast our disinterested judgment and recognize their actions as truly heroic. Arendt's habit of focusing on the genealogy of words leads her to connect the term action to its Greek and Latin origins. Through this exercise of linguistical analysis, she thematizes the term action as divided into two different parts, the beginning and the achievement. In the history of its use, beginnings were related to the rules and the commands, whereas the execution of those commands belonged to their subjects. Agonism might be in the quality of a beginning that shows itself only through the initiative a leader takes. However, we become aware of the achievement in its full measure once it has been performed and recaptured in the story. Arendt is careful to stress this point because, as she notices, even if the ruler believes he is alone in achieving his deeds, it is a fallacy because it is actually the achievement of many. Thus, action for Arendt always relates to the idea of establishing relationships with others, even the most agonistic ones, which can only be possible because of those others that support and follow the leader. Therefore, Arendt calls agonistic actions as boundlessness. In order to redress this feature of boundlessness from her concept of agonistic action, we need a normative criteria that sets the limits of the productivity of an action. On the one hand, actors striving for agonistic actions must force themselves to exercise moderation, keeping within bounds, because when leading and achieving great deeds, one is always tempted to the will of power, that is, to what the Greeks call hubris. On the other hand, not all agonistic actions can be thematized as truly heroic in normative terms. Only the actions that transform societies and to ameliorate relations between humans in terms of social justice can be called as great deeds. Thus, heroic actions must bear some kind of moral altruism. The most interesting part of Arendt's analysis of agonistic actions is concentrated in her section called The Greek Solution. Arendt insisted on the inherent character of the unpredictability of action. She does not believe that agonistic actors can remain heroes in the public for a very long time. This is especially relevant if we consider how political leaders always run the risk of losing their appeal on the public. Arendt says that the unpredictability of the outcome is closely related to the revelatory character of action and speech. She turns again to the Greek idea of eudaimon and clarifies that for the Greeks, it was a quality only attached to those who had died. In the same token, the Romans believed something very similar in their proverbial saying, Nemo ante mortem beatus esse dici potest. This is the reason why for the Catholics, the ritual of making saints of their heroes was possibly only once they were dead. Thus, Arendt relates the idea of agonistic qualities with those who can become heroes, but she adds a new sense of agency in the idea of freedom developed through stressing the elements of the leader's fragility and of their fallibility. The expression of eudaimonia means the blessedness, but without the religious overtones, and it means literally something like the well-being of the daimon who accompanies each man throughout life, who is his distinct identity, but appears and is visible only to others. Thus, the interconnection between freedom and plurality, both highlight the idea of our fragile selves. Perhaps this is the most outstanding feature of Arendt's idea of agonism. Uniqueness is distinction, but we cannot rely on our blessedness, for there is no possible way to know all the consequences of our actions. Actions are complex, and through them, we learn about our freedom and the dilemmas of our choices. This is the reason why the quality of agonism deals with the idea that we, humans, are incapable of being just heroes, or about the impossibility of becoming living saints. Furthermore, Arendt argues that whoever consciously aims at being essential, at leaving behind a story, and of achieving an identity to win immortal fame, must not only risk his life, but expressly choose to lose it. Achilles' life was a short one, and it was a premature death. He only remained a hero after the story was told by Homer. Many people might be led to believe that Arendt was thinking that the hero who strives for immortality must choose death to achieve it. This is, of course, the superficial reading of her paragraph. On a more careful reading, however, one can connect Arendt's idea of agonistic heroes to her idea about the unpredictability of action. This connection makes the hero a fragile one, because things can turn in a different way than planned. One can also connect it to the idea that the story does not belong to the hero himself, and that it can only be told by another once judgment is passed. This again makes the connection to the idea that it is interpretation, the judgment, what brings light to a truly heroic action. Both ideas together can be contrasted with Arendt's earlier commentaries about the need to be moderate in the political domain, and the idea that hubris is the most dangerous element of human action. This is the reason why she can conclude that, and I'm quoting her, "Only a man who does not survive his own supreme act remains the indisputable master of his identity and possible greatness, because he withdraws into death from the possible consequences and continuation of what he began." Understanding agonistic action, therefore, means realizing that no one can be a permanent hero except the ones who are already dead. It is the public judgment that will make her a hero through the recovery of her action in the full expression of her story. It also means that whoever consciously pursues greatness is doomed to fail, for we cannot aspire to become saints or gods. We are only humans. If this quality of agonism is not clarified enough through the arguments I have developed, then we should focus on how Arendt says that what made Achilles the hero of his times was that Homer could focus on the singleness and uniqueness of Achilles' action, because he summed up all of his life into one single deed, so that the story of the act comes to its end together with life itself. Indeed, if we look at the stories of our contemporary heroes, only those who have succumbed to death have found the greatness of being considered heroes. Erase from our memories are all their mistakes. By releasing them through their deaths, were able to capture their greatness of their actions as expanding themselves throughout all their lives as if they were a symbolic whole. We recall only the striving forces that made our heroes pursue their goals. Often, those goals led to important transformations of their societies. Thus, the impartiality that comes with time allows disinterested judgment. From Gandhi to Martin Luther King Jr., our heroes have stayed in our memories because we only recall their heroic deeds. Likewise, if we focus on the presence of a political leader, we always find our negative reactions towards some issues which we regard as negative consequences of their own actions. There are always mistakes to be considered. Sometimes those mistakes become even more important than the greatness of the previous deeds. Thus, as we have seen, Arendt relates her idea of agonism to her idea of judgment. As Dana Vila argues, the meaning of action is seen by Arendt as predicated upon a twofold death of the author. The actor does not create meaning as the artist does a work, nor can judging spectators redeem this meaning unless they are able, in some measure, to forget themselves. The meaning of forgetting ourselves is what the spectator wins with time. Once we can be detached from our immediate interests and from all our idiosyncratic values and prejudices. Many of the interesting interpretations of Arendt's idea of agonism, which link the aesthetic with the moral domain, assert that Arendt thought of the important capacity to adjust to the idea of an ever-growing plurality, relating it to the idea of agonistic beginnings. Kimberly Curtis claims, for example, that the crucial point here is that our capacity to experience a world in common, to constitute a certain world solidity, is utterly dependent upon the engendering ground of plurality itself, upon the aesthetic provocation of multiple distinct appearing beings. For this reason, Curtis calls this feature of Arendt's work as aesthetic provocation. However, the aesthetic provocation is meaningless if it is not provided with the content of emancipatory goals. And I still need to argue this in terms of a clearer connection to the moral sphere. We still need to show how is it possible that agonism can play an important part in achieving the goals of justice. I have thought of doing this through showing some historical examples of great moral guides of our last century. I will focus on how they constructed their agonistic paths, weaving them with moral goals. Those leaders will be called the new social subjects. In my view, they opened the gate for a post-colonial world of global politics. In doing so, they allow us to begin by reframing the space of our actions in a more ample way, that is, in global terms. This feature means that all the social subjects that I consider as examples of the global world have participated, opened their agendas to more than just one place which they want to transform. A second condition is that their influence has been wider than within the boundaries of one country. This condition makes their contribution an open-ended one, for there are always other possibilities to use their examples from people who are in other parts of the world. A third condition, as we have seen in Arendt's own view of agonism, is that the process of intervention is a carefully crafted one, one that involves the choice of the participant to make an imprint in her society, but it also entails a whole process of framing her struggle into an important emancipatory one. Therefore, those agonistic social subjects reframe their claims of social justice in terms of global justice, and by doing that, they become the heroes of our agenda for globalizing justice. The historical breakpoint where I'm going to begin for redefining justice as global justice can be situated in the context of a time when post-colonial contributions to democracy began enriching Western traditions. My main example is, of course, Mohandas Karamchand Gandhi, who was born in 1869 in the coastal town of Porbandar, a part that belongs now to the Indian state of Gujarat. Before Gandhi built his revolutionary concept of peaceful resistance, he needed to understand the nature of the need to intervene in the public affairs of his time. South Africa served as his first scenery, where he became an agonistic actor driven by moral impulses of social justice. As Bhikkhu Parekh explains, when traveling from Durban to Pretoria, he was thrown out of a train in the middle of the night for daring to travel first class and spent the rest of his night shivering in the waiting room at Pietermaritzburg station. The distraught Gandhi debated whether to return to India or stay on and fight for his rights. His impulse to participate in public affairs was since the beginning related to his idea of fighting for social justice and inclusion. Here is his own narration of the story. I began to think of duty. Should I fight for my rights or go back to India? Or should I go on to Pretoria without minding the insults and return to India after finishing the case? It would be cowardice to run back to India without fulfilling my obligation. The hardships to which I was subjected was superficial, only a symptom of the deep disease of color prejudice. I should try, if possible, to root out the disease and suffer hardships in the process. Redress the wrongs I should seek only to the extent that would be necessary for the removal of color prejudice. Only after years of much struggle, Gandhi created his method of Satyagraha, a form of nonviolent resistance that would make an imprint in global politics. In order to do so, Gandhi had to understand Western democratic institutions and how to question them by radicalizing its normative principles through his reading of them as an outsider. Thus, it was not a coincidence that he was then in South Africa. It was there where he experienced much social injustice. His craft of moral agonistic intervention was inspired in three important readings he had done during this period. Henry Thoreau's On the Duty of Civil Disobedience, Leo Tolstoy, The Kingdom of God Within You, and John Ruskin, Until This Last. These three authors influenced him in different ways. From Thoreau, he learned the important idea of democratic civil disobedience. From Tolstoy, he claimed to have discovered the idea of love and nonviolence. And from Ruskin, he took the idea of building his moral self as an act of self-creation. These distinctive features that come from these readings include his conscious choice to become a public figure as a second birth. Gandhi connected his idea of moral character to the learning experiences of an Ausbildung. It was at this point, as Parekh shows, that Gandhi became convinced that a political leader must be morally pure and embarked on a program of personal moral development. Gandhi's method of political disobedience started by a peaceful picketing of registration centers, burning registration cards, curting arrest, and gracefully accepting such a punishment as was meted out. And later on was followed by the struggle to include women and minors against impositions of poll tax, the refusal to recognize Indian marriages, immigration regulations, and the system of indentured labor. This was Gandhi's first success, because it led to the passage of the Indian Relief Act in 1914. That Gandhi became well aware of his possibilities to change his reality is one of the interesting features of his agonistic intervention. This is the reason why he insisted to his fellow citizens on the need to rebel against themselves, to prove to them that they needed to change themselves before changing their unjust world. This insistence provided a new concept of political agency, one that was not based on the idea that Indians were only victims of colonialism, but rather that they were capable of creating a new society which could find its sources of pride in rescuing their traditions as symbols of renewed progressive practices. Thus, he added to his new concept of agency a further level by providing a reflexive level through offering his example as a moral guide. The distinctive features of civil disobedience that were capturing Gandhi's method made him a hero of an important global initiative. His creation was not literally copied from Thoreau's own idea. Rather, only someone like Gandhi himself, who came from experiencing violence, who saw the futility of it, and who understood the way violence corrodes societies and its institutions like a cancerous disease, could have exerted that violence was evil. Instead, he focused on his fellow citizens and insisted to them that they should build up moral courage, cultural self-confidence, and the capacity for concerted action among the masses. it was only then that he thought that his Satyagraha method, earlier developed in South Africa, could be an important tool for his purposes of the social transformation of India. In his agenda of national regeneration, he included equality for women, health education, use of indigenous languages, adoption of a common national language, economic equality, building up peasant and workers' organizations, integration of the tribal people into mainstream societies, a detailed call for students, code for students, helping the poor and the sick, and cultivating respect for animals. Thus, it is clear that his agonistic intervention was motivated by a moral agenda. The moral agenda, however, came through Gandhi's own immersion on the true understanding of religions. This is another very important feature that many of our global heroes possess. Religion provides the contents of their own impulses. It was then that Gandhi stumbled into the extraordinary process of religious translation, which I have called now creation, to provide the world with a new idea of a political authority based on justice and truth. The kind of authority was the only capable of providing an imagined, free, and independent India. It was the new way to define Indian identity as plural and tolerant. This new approach provided an agenda for social justice and inclusion. As Parekh has argued, partly conscious design and partly spontaneous expressions of his whole way of life, his dress, language, mode of public speaking, food, bodily gestures, ways of sitting, walking, talking, laughter, humor, and staff became symbols of a specific way of life. The world opened itself again to more global influences through the figure who changed our ideas about civil rights. Indeed, it was only when Martin Luther King Jr. radicalized the reading of the principles of the American Constitution that we understood how partial and selective they have been used. King's judgment and his effort to grasp the heroic achievements of Gandhi stimulated his own initiative to unfold, as it can be proven by reading King's own words. In his autobiography, when he describes the connection to Gandhi as the most influential he had stumbled upon, he writes, "One Sunday afternoon, I traveled to Philadelphia to hear a sermon by Dr. Mordecai Johnson. Dr. Johnson had just returned from a trip to India, and to my great interest, he spoke of the life and teachings of Mahatma Gandhi. His message was so profound and electrifying that I left the meeting and bought a half dozen books on Gandhi's life and works. As I read it, I became deeply fascinated by his campaigns of nonviolent resistance. The whole concept of Satyagraha, Satya is truth which equals love, and agraha is force," he says. King, "Satyagraha therefore means truth force or love force, and it was profoundly significant to me. As I delve deeper into the philosophy of Gandhi, my skepticism concerning the power of love gradually diminished, and I came to see for the first time its potency in the area of social reform." Since the age of 14, as he was preparing to write the composition for school, King had the trouble of understanding the inconsistencies between a truly democratic document like the American Constitution and its factual ways of contradicting it. Thus, he began his critical stance as soon as he started writing in his youth about the Constitution. King Jr. focused on how to read the principles of democracy and on how to understand the American Constitution in a more radical manner. Like Gandhi himself, Luther King Jr. had to understand democracy and the failures of the partial reading of its universal principles from the point of view of someone who has been a second-class citizen. In studying liberalism, King Jr. saw that one of the problems of such a theory is, and I'm quoting him, its superficial optimism concerning human nature. King was capable of seeing with great clarity that the complexity of man's social involvement had to come, he says, in the glaring reality of collective evil. The coincidence with Gandhi's own concern with evil is not a casual one. It was in relation to evil where Gandhi helped him visualize a new concept of a political horizon. For as he later argued, my study of Gandhi convinced me that true pacifism is non-resistance to evil, but non-violent resistance to evil. Gandhi resisted evil with as much vigor and power as a violent resister, but he resisted with love instead of hate. The feature of love, which for Gandhi was originally inspired by Tolstoy in King, came from the biblical worldviews as they were developed by the Black Church. It was here where he connected the views of his country with another story from the African national liberation. As Ron Ayerman, a professor of sociology in Uppsala, by the way, notices, in a sermon given to his Montgomery congregation in 1957, after he had been in Ghana to witness an independence celebration, King related the situation facing American blacks to the history of colonialism by mediating through his own experience. In pronouncing the sermon entitled The Birth of a New Nation, King made his second birth and entered the world by connecting the African freedom struggle with that of American blacks through biblical analogy. At the same time, as he makes it clear that freedom will not be achieved by a return to Africa, but rather through inclusion in America. King recovered from the Enlightenment the key concepts he wanted to introduce for his political program: freedom, solidarity, and social inclusion. The most interesting feature of King's conceptual agenda was how he reappropriated the legacy of American Constitution by reading the concepts of freedom and equality in a more radical and universal fashion. This radical force came from his religious sources. It was not the religious legacy from the white Protestant church, but rather the readings and the emancipatory goals of the Black church. Here, King drew his own originality and made his imprint in the same manner as Gandhi had done it earlier. If Gandhi introduced the idea of nonviolent resistance, King thought of creating the idea of social inclusion as separated from desegregation. His main goal was to transform the whole country of the United States into a more democratic one. He could only do so by understanding what social inclusion means in terms of universal justice. In his description about the goals of emancipation, which he needed, he first focused on the description of Rosa Parks' action in December 1st of 1955. King Jr. claimed that Mrs. Parks' refusal to move back was her intrepid and courageous affirmation to the world that she had had enough. The concept of resistance had to be transformed into a new political meaning in order to be capable of expressing the need to change the whole of society. Social inclusion became the key political transformative concept. King claimed that integration is creative and is therefore more profound and far-reaching than desegregation. He also related his idea of inclusion to the American legacy, and he argued that this idea of the dignity and worth of human personality is expressed eloquently and unequivocally in the Declaration of Independence. Furthermore, he added later, Frederick Douglass stated the same truth in his lecture of the Constitution of the United States. Its language is, we the people, not we the white people, not we the citizens, not we the privileged class, not we the high, not we the low, but we the people, we the human inhabitants. And if Negroes are people, they are included in the benefits for which the Constitution of America was ordained and established. At this point, King began to read Thoreau's essay on civil disobedience, and he became convinced that we were preparing to do in Montgomery, he says, what Thoreau had clearly expressed with his idea of civil disobedience, namely, that we can no longer lend our cooperation to an evil system. King's profound understanding of democracy was that we harm democratic institutions if we cannot live to its highest aspirations of justice. It is then when King consciously took the choice to become an agonistic leader of his times. as he describes to us. Here's his description. I was faced with the inescapable task of preparing, in almost no time at all, a speech that was expected to give some sense of direction to a people imbued with a new and still unplumbed passion for justice. I was also conscious that reporters and television men would be there with their pencils and sound cameras poised to record my words and send them across the nation. It was at this point, says King, where I became an example. Ron Ireman calls the hero of a progressive narrative, calls him a hero of a progressive narrative because his aim was to struggle for social inclusion as the most emancipatory goals of his times. In this sermon, given at the Hall Street Baptist Church after Rosa Parks' arrest, King proved himself capable of succeeding as a moral leader. As we read in his autobiography, his sense of possibilities were shaken, but he strove to find the shining brightness, the agonistic impulses, which aren't referred to when defining the agonistic features of this kind of leadership. King had to begin by reframing political action away from resentment, hatred, and violence. He then met this challenge by combining what he called two irreconcilables. He says, I would seek to arouse the group to action by insisting that their self-respect was at stake and that if they accepted such injustices without protesting, they would betray their own sense of dignity and the eternal edicts of God himself. King's concept of agency catapulted the idea of self-respect as a condition to activate it. King claimed to his black public that they had to work together and, he says, when the history books are written in the future, somebody will have to say, there live a race of people, a black people, a people who had the moral courage to stand up for their rights, and thereby they injected a new meaning into the veins of history and of civilization. He knew that he was referring to the future judgment upon his actions and those actions of his fellow citizens together. This judgment could only be possible, King thought, because of the glory of democracy. Indeed, King succeeded in creating a new sense of agency based on a reading of the American Constitution and on the legacy of the Black Church. His inclusionary idea was meant to question the possibility that there can be real justice when principles can be applied only to one privileged group. Social integration means that the possibility to enjoy freedom and equality with others and among others is a universal condition of humankind. He concluded that his idea of integration stressed an even more universal appeal by connecting integration as the recognition of solidarity. As Ironman notices, he revitalized and revoiced religious legacies to fit the needs of mobilization in the struggle to include blacks into brotherhood on the secular plane of American society. By transforming the traditions of the black church to fit the framework of the progressive narrative, where he also inserted himself as part of the progressive narratives of the American legacy. King was capable of allowing the movement of civil rights to be framed as the struggle to radicalize the goals of American democracy. This strategy of inclusion was radically new. King argued that in bringing justice to the world, blacks needed the solidarity and help of other people, whites, but the whites needed the black community in order to make the United States a more democratic country. This interconnection made the idea of inclusion a totally different one from other ideas of integration before King. With King's achievement, Gandhi's legacy was renewed, and it demonstrated how capable of inspiring new leaderships was. Public judgment was passed. Through the recovery of Gandhi's story of liberation, Martin Luther King Jr. reenacted the plot of freedom. He wrote a new chapter by linking black society to justice and to another hero. If Gandhi achieved the possibility of leading India into a post-colonial freedom, King made the idea of social inclusion the newer frame where civil rights were granted. The two stories were finally intertwined. King's own judgment described the importance of Gandhi's legacy. We find that both leaders, Gandhi and King Jr., found their death in the pursuit of justice. Arendt thought that only after such an ending they could become truly moral heroes. In our reassessment of the stories, our public judgment, both figures can provide us with important moral lessons. We learn from their stories important normative conditions that should help us draw features for our future moral guides. One might say that both leaders represent important examples of what I have called the new global subjects. First, Gandhi worked in South Africa, then in India, and finally made it an impact beyond his frontiers, as exemplified when King Jr. refurbished his own example. King, too, he began by considering his idea of social integration only after he witnessed some of the processes of the African liberation movements and their post-colonial stage. He then traveled to India and sought to reunite his idea of integration with Gandhi's method of nonviolent resistance. With his action, King became the symbol for all the struggles for civil rights in the whole world. Second, they both were considered as second-class citizens. The readings of the normative principles of democracy come through their radicalization of outsiders' views. Third, they brought their initiative of democratizing their societies through a more radical reading of the principles of democracy and about how to expand the meaning of universal justice. Fourth, both of them were looking for social inclusion and not exclusionary goals. This is a very important and restrictive principle which might give us some clarity in order to judge who can be considered moral leaders of our times. Finally, both were capable of creating an important language of justice through a reworking of their traditions. They accomplished the creation of a new sense of agency and political authority based on their inspired views about religious insights. Now, the last part, and I'm concluding, we might begin by enlisting some of the achievements on a conceptual order. First, they have made use of a creative notion of rights. Second, they needed to connect their struggles for justice to the approval of world public opinion. Third, they conceptualized democracy as promoting and radicalizing the goals they saw as belonging to social justice. Fourth, their conscious choice of becoming political leaders made their agonistic initiatives widen our scopes about the potentials of globalizing justice. And fifth, they enlarged the conceptual ground of agonistic impulses by adding new meanings to its conceptual frame. This was done through the idea that influence, the only concept of moral authority that can persuade and achieve emancipatory goals of justice. Influence is not a kind of irrational charisma, but a conscious choice to follow a path of moral actions that lend credibility to the political leader. Thus, only after their achievements were done can we say that their kind of authority is moral, and not only the result of charismatic authority in its Weberian terms. I have chosen three examples that I wish to now suggest to you as future leaders, but as you know, nothing can be said in a determinative way. I have chosen the names of Václav Havel, Baltasar Garzón, and Rigoberta Menchú. First, these leaders were fundamental in allowing us to realize how the idea of rights have become creative tools in redefining justice. They have connected the idea of rights with the idea of communicative spaces, and with that move, they have fully extended the level of rights to a stage of discursive strategies, to the paradigm of communicative action. The connection between the idea of civil society and the powerful creative mirror of discourse rights, where they can reflect themselves, is apparent in the way the new definition about rights have been parts of their new democratic identity. The interesting feature about the idea of using rights to open spaces for democracy is that when a civil society is emerging out of a transition, it needs to reflect itself into new institutional spaces. The only way to do so is by creating itself around a regulative idea of rights, because rights relate to legal institutions and to international institutions of law. Authoritarian regimes do not recognize rights, but the international community and the international institutions of law do. This is the key connection to democracy and to globalization. It means that rights becomes a substantial embodiment of discourses about new interpretation of needs and the new possibilities for appearance of discursive voices from emergent actors. For those living outside mainstream societies, it is the only possible way out of their authoritarian regimes. Thus, rights have a mediating role as a whole series of institutions because they possess a double status as institutions of civil society and as self-limitations of the state. Havel's idea about political and civil rights, Garçon's idea about international rights, and Menchu's idea about human rights have all changed our horizon of understanding the role of rights discourses in expanding the boundaries of democratic spaces. Second, the opening up of the idea of radicalizing democracy as extending its boundaries out of state rights provides our new space for the concept of globalizing justice. Struggles for transitions into democracy, Havel, struggles for the internationalizing the idea of the accountability and of the global scope of justice, Garçon, and struggles to be included as members of humankind, Menchu, all needed the linkages between international institutions of law and real civil societies beyond the nation state. Thus, in implementing new understandings and regulations about rights, in actualizing rights and in redefining rights, the international arena needed the intervention of these moral leaders in order to connect themselves and their societies with the international civil societies. Third, in conceiving a specific connection between rights and the possibility to enlarge democracy, these examples stress the fact that rights are also the expression of the institutionalization of a higher level of learning and of reflection within state institutions. Fourth, the category of influence, which I will propose as an important feature of our notion of moral authority, stresses the idea that influence is a communicative skill. It is a way in which we can voice common opinions, norms, and forms of participation, all seen as basis of group formation and of solidarity in order to constitute a political community. Influence must not be understood as restricted to members of cultural elites like Havel, Garçon, or Menchu, because the term stresses that those who can articulate opinion and projects of groups and associations can also become influential, but they can influence through arguments only. And my end. Sorry, because I go through a revision of all these examples. So, the development of the idea of agonism through the historical examples must be clear now, I hope. We need to return once more to Arendt in order to complete the last stage of our commitment to set the normative criteria for such a concept. Arendt sought to disentangle the idea that action and making belong to the same realm. Action needed an autonomous space of its own. With a stark rejection about an interconnection between action and making, she opened the space of action to the realm of freedom. Action and freedom are inextricably related. On the other hand, Arendt was capable of giving us one very important insight about agonistic action, which I have tried to develop here. This insight lies in the fact that we cannot look for an external criteria to make a normative concept of agonism. This is the reason why I needed to relate the idea of a moral agenda to moral authority, to the idea of the moral authority of the leader. I try to show how an agonistic intervention shows how the person's altruistic motives compelled her to act heroically. This is the reason why the moral and the aesthetic dimensions can be entangled. This is also the reason why I had to use historical examples. Arendt, on the other hand, pursued the idea of finding an inherent normative criteria for agonistic actions by using the concepts of forgiveness and promises. They were seen as ways in which we can undo what we began, or we can transform what others began. It relates to our capacity to change something and to our capacity to begin something new. This is because we need, and I'm quoting her, to remedy the unpredictability for the uncertainty of the future. We need a faculty to make and keep promises in order to establish the common link with others. We need to establish new relationships. This is the reason why in this chapter, in this paper, I have tried to show how the agonistic efforts of certain emancipatory kind cannot be conceived without first achieving some kind of moral authority with others. The idea of influence is the communicative space that can be open when our capacity to make and keep our promises is coherently developed. The conclusion of this is that we need the normative criteria of public judgment for agonistic actions. We can understand the heroicness of an actor once we understand how their initiatives led to important transformations of social interrelations. Judgments make us aware of the need to forgive our heroes' past mistakes. With judgment, we can also be capable of measuring the courage of our leaders' initiatives. At the same time, those actors whose promises made us follow them have taught us how important this new relationship is for we share our political world of human affairs. If promises are kept, we know that something more than instrumental reason was at stake. Promises are ways in which those actors maintain their own moral integrity. It is because of the presence of others who confirm the identity between the one who promises and the one who fulfills it that we can acknowledge who the hero truly is. Thus, it is a moral code, Arendt tells us. We reach the full level of a normative criteria by inferring the faculties of forgiving and of making promises. It rests, says Arendt, on experiences which nobody could ever have with himself, which on the contrary are entirely based on the presence of others, and thus it relates to a communicative paradigm. Arendt's final conclusion is that in understanding the political realm of agonistic action, we may grasp the tragic measures of our freedom. This is the reason why Arendt introduces forgivenesses and promises as our capacities to begin something new. The one miracle-working faculty of man, says Arendt, as Jesus of Nazareth, whose insights into this faculty can be compared in their originality and unprecedentedness with Socrates' insights into the possibility of thought, must have known very well when he likened the power to forgive to the more general power of performing miracles, putting both on the same level, as within and within the reach of man. Thank you very much.